So let me start first with who am I. And my name is Alexandra Fedorova, and my IRC nickname is Bookwar, and maybe you can see me in some other places under this nickname. So I'm long-term Fedora ambassador, and formerly I worked in Mirantis OpenStack distribution, managing releases of a distribution itself and a fuel component of it. And currently I'm working as continuous integration engineer at Trivago. And as no one knows what continuous integration engineer is, that's the person who tries to make sure that development workflows fit into the deployment workflows you use in production. So I'm kind of trying to help developers and admins to find the communication way, the way to communicate and to improve on these integration pipelines. So if you have questions, comments, and discussions, want to discuss something, then you can find me today and tomorrow at Fedora booth. You can write me and you can comment on my small blog at Medium. So today we're going to talk about a lot of stuff, but mainly let me explain the subtitle. So the obviously, this talk is very entry level and it's totally not enough for managing Kubernetes cluster or for like real working with it. But what I meant by this title is that whenever you are developer or sysadmin or even product manager or product owner, you need a certain base level how Kubernetes works, so you will be able to talk with people about Kubernetes and the work and the services. So this talk presents a safe minimum for anyone who's going to work around this topic, and I hope you will enjoy it. So yeah, we are going to talk about containers and Kubernetes, and as I'm a CI engineer, I want to give a bit of a context and start from the very beginning. And first, the question to the audience, who works with Docker? Awesome. And who works with Kubernetes? Awesome as well. Cool. So I'm going to start with very, very basic stuff. What are containers and what are VMs? There's a lot to talk about, but mainly for purpose of from the point of developer who created his application or just from a very generic high-level point of view. Virtual machine has its own kernel process. Container uses the host kernel from the host, and this is the main difference in the organization of containerized and virtualized processes. So this main difference leads us to first note that containers are generally not secure, and as our container user space has direct access to host kernel, that's definitely a not secure situation, and you can execute code on a host system from a container, generally. There are more to the topic, but this is observation number one, and observation number two are just that containers are generally weird. It's promised by container developers, the like evangelists of container systems, that containers are cross-platform, easy to move from one system to another, but generally you always need to have in mind that containers are represent a very hybrid operating system. You take arbitrary kernel, you add arbitrary user space, and you hope that it will work. It it generally does, but not always. So the generic takeaways I like to point for like general overview for a container is that, first of all, used only trusted sources, and still never trust user inside the container unless you invest a lot of resources into researching the container security topics. And I guess there will be talk about container security right after the lunch here, maybe. And as we have this kernel and user space discrepancy, we shouldn't rely really on kernel or system level features. in a container. Generally, usually container applications are the essentially user space applications like web frontends or generic services. But the thing is, it's impossible to not rely at least on some kernel features, even if you are a high-level application developer. So there was a recent example with PHP 7 container where everything broke because of a different kernel on the host system, because PHP 7 relies on a certain implementation of random numbers. And when you work with random numbers, this leads us to kernel implementation of random numbers. And there was a bug on container of PHP 7 application, which wasn't able to run on recent Fedora, for example, just because the kernel was different. So even if you're an application developer, you're not safe, and you might get into issues with different kernels. And so every time you work with containers, you should test containers in the same host system which you will use in production. They, like, develop in any system you want, do what you want, but before you push it to the real-life production system, you should always test it on the same kind of host system, even if you hope this is a cross-platform application. Now, containers are all good and nice, and basically container technology has been around for 10 years or more. But here comes Docker, and what Docker adds to containerization, I think, first of all, Docker just appeared in the right time when container technology becomes mature enough to be properly used. But Docker also adds a lot of stuff around around the container technology itself. So Docker adds an ecosystem to manage containers, to work with them, and to share them, and so on. So for for our high-level overview, Docker can be considered as a way of managing layered images for containers. So container technology is one thing, but Docker adds a sort of a Git repository for containers. And this one thing which is useful for application developers is to understand the layering structure of Docker images, because it's often people consider Docker as just an isolation mechanism and sharing mechanism, but they forget about internal layering structure. And with these layers, it becomes really ugly sometimes when you have huge images which contain basically nothing. Like in this example, you can see that this is a container which is used mostly for building Java apps. And you see that we have a Docker file, which is the recipe for a container image. And we start from a base layer. We add layer 1, which is a layer with a Gradle binary. And we add layer 2, which is layer with protobuf compiler. And you can see that this Docker file is looks a bit weird, because I do apt-get update and apt-get clean several times. But the reason for that is, again, that every instruction creates a certain layer, and this layer you will keep with you whenever you move one container from one system to another. So you always want to have your layers as minimal as possible. Thus, if you use apt-get, for example, you always need to clean cache in the same instruction where you updated it, so you don't carry it with you because you don't need it ever. And with this layered images, as I said, Docker kind of creates the Git for containers. There's, of course, more to it, which Docker adds. Docker adds networking, Docker adds volumes, and you can mount directories from a host system in a container. You can create shared volumes and so on. So there is more to the topic, but generally, for the purpose of this kind of talk, you can safely think that Docker is layering and everything else can be added later. Now, once you have these containers, then you have a way to store and share and reuse them. Now, containers become a way to package software and to deliver it. And I want to put this a bit in the context, how the continuous integration with containers can look like. So mainly, containers are used in continuous integration in two very different distinct ways. So one way you use container in CI is that this is your built environment, the built tool, and generally you have this Git repository with your source code, you have an application artifact which you want to produce, and you have your built infrastructure environment like dependencies, toolchain, all related stuff to the build process. And you can, like, old school way of managing it by installing this on a worker slaves is really hard to maintain because every application nowadays requires its own environment, and if we don't want to agree on the common baseline for using some dependencies and so on. So container image in CI is very helpful to solve this problem. You put all your dependencies, build cache, Git cache, dependency cache, all in container image, and then you can safely use it to build this particular application, create the application artifact, push the artifact to storage, and then you can just discard the container and never use it again. But this is just one application of a containers, which is very, very helpful on the infrastructure level, but this is not enough. So as soon as we go further with containers, we want to use containers in production. And here, this is a critically different kind of container, because here we use our application code as as a source, and we build container image as an artifact as a result of our continuous integration, continuous delivery process, and this container image is our production artifact. So the pipeline which builds this kind of container images is completely different. It has different way of approval of changes. Like if your build tools have more libraries than needed, or if your build tools fail by some reason, you don't care. If it's production container, then there's much more to it. You need much better testing, you need much better storage, and so on. So the life cycle of a certain application can look like this. You have your source code, you put it in Git repository, hopefully. Then you take the code from a Git repo, you do some building, you produce an artifact. In my case, this is a jar. You publish jar to your repository again. This is a Maven repository, for example. Then you take your jar, you build your a Docker image containing this jar, you publish this Docker image to Docker registry. And this image in that Docker registry is your final artifact which goes to production environment. And here there are two containers I were talking about. So for Gradle build, you use this build container for CI, which is your disposable container with all your build tools. And for the final artifact, there is a container for production, which is totally different from the one you use for building. So currently there's a lot of issues when people try to merge both of those containers into one, and this is why Docker, for example, invented the format which is, I cannot remember how it's properly called, but currently you can have basically two stages in a Docker file, the build stage and the production stage. But I prefer to have this as a completely two different Docker files and different manage it differently, build differently, maintain differently. So now we have come to the registry with our Docker images, and like we obviously want to run our application in production. And here is where the fun starts. because you container images are not enough. You need to understand how many of those processes with these container images you run, how they interact, how to update them, how to roll out, how to roll back, how to reschedule to different hosts, and so on. And this is where the Kubernetes comes into our discussion, because Kubernetes is an orchestration platform. This is taken from the Kubernetes main site, so it's kind of a mission statement for Kubernetes project. So the whole idea of Kubernetes project is to operate those, orchestrate those containers and container images we have produced in the previous step. And Kubernetes is a whole new thing because it is a platform which provides a certain framework in which you want to dig in. And Kubernetes has a lot of helpful objects and abstractions which are helpful for you as an admin or developer or anyone. But this means also that it has a lot of new terms and the whole new language you need to learn before you start working with it. And this is the some of the main terms in the Kubernetes setup, which like everyone who's working with Kubernetes must learn and must know, because like this is the language you use to describe what you're doing with this orchestration cluster. So obviously we have this image with our application. The image is stored in a registry. Now we have a container. Container runs images. Some containers can run the same image. Some containers run different. Now we have this new term, which is pod. And this is basically just a group of containers. And we have a node, which is a host system for pods. Node is mean, you can imagine it's a bare metal host or a virtual machine. It can be anything. It can be virtual machine in OpenStack. It can be bare metal. It can be Amazon instance. And obviously you have this Kubernetes cluster as a set of nodes. And then you have these three more abstractions, which we are going into details later. So just this is the layout of a Kubernetes cluster in generic layout, how it looks like. So we have cluster, multiple nodes. Every node has different has a lot of pods. Every pod has a lot of containers. Generally, there is a one-to-one mapping between pod and container, and we probably will see why is that. So this is the layout of these objects, and now we like putting objects in this kind of layout is one thing, but now you need to work with this, and this is where the management abstractions come in. So how do you manage pods? So from Kubernetes points of view, Kubernetes never works with individual containers. It always works with predefined groups of containers. So we just are not interested in managing container alone. We always have this a set of containers which we put in a pod. And it's most common case, there is one container per pod, and this means that pod is just a wrapper object around your one base application container. So first, when you start to work with pods and containers, the first notion you need to know is a replica set. So a replica set is when you define a certain application, you want to go make microservices, obviously, everyone wants to. And you never want one container with one application. You want a set of them, and this is called replica set. A replica set has a counter, the number of containers which belong to this replica set. All of them, number of pods. All of those pods are equal. This is just the scaling of one pod into multiple components. So here in this example, we have a Nginx container, which it's put into Nginx pod, and this pod is a member, every pod is a member of replica set for Nginx, and the replica counter here is 4. So main main property of a replica set in a Kubernetes cluster is that, that replica set can be scaled up and scaled down. So replica counter is a parameter which can be changed during the lifetime of a replica set. And Kubernetes will deal with scheduling this new pod to some node, which if it finds that if you increase the replica counter, Kubernetes scheduler will find a way to run one more pod of the same kind on some of the nodes. So scheduling is done by Kubernetes, everything is done by Kubernetes. You just basically set this replica number to plus one. But having replica sets is cool, but it manages like the number of pods, but it doesn't touch the content of pods. So once you define the replica set, you define the content of a pod, and then you just scale up, scale down. That's all you do with this object. So there's one more thing which you need once you start working with replica sets. As again, as we are going to scale up, scale down, we obviously want, we don't just scale up, scale down for the fun of it. We want to load balancing of a certain service onto many instances of an application. That's the reason why we scale. So that's why here comes one more concept, which is the concept of a service. Service is a common endpoint for a replica set. It can be a common endpoint for one replica set, but you also can have several replica sets under the umbrella of a certain service. You even, there are more to it, you can have services based on certain selectors. So you can have, you can choose pods by some label and assign service to them. So there is a flexible tool. So mainly service is a common endpoint for the group of pods and which are in replica sets. So in this example, I have two replica sets with different version of Nginx application inside, and I have a common common service assigned to them. Now, so we have replica sets, we have service. So we can scale replicas, service will be adjusted accordingly. So everything is done automatically by Kubernetes. Once you add more stuff into your replica set, service will include them as well. But again, this is not enough. You need a way to update your content of your pods. And this is where deployment object comes. Because deployment object, it means you add an update strategy to your replica sets. So obviously you can do everything manually. You can set up your replica set. You can set up the second replica set with Nginx of version 2. And you can migrate your workload from one to another. But Kubernetes is good because it already does everything for you and you don't need to care. So deployment object manages updates for replica sets. So in this example, I have deployment object Nginx, which was at first set up as a deployment object with a replica set with Nginx version 1. But then I want to roll out new Nginx version 2. I set up the rollout update process in Kubernetes, and then Kubernetes takes care, so it creates the second replica set with second version. It starts to scale down the first replica set by one. So it cuts one pod from old replica set and adds one pod to the new replica set and keeps service working to both replica sets in between. So it just replaces one replica set by another, steadily, one by one, and keeping everything in working state in the meantime. So deployment object has a higher level abstraction, which provides this wrapping around the updates of replica sets for you. So now it was all good and abstract, but now we come to more interesting tasks, which are the networking. So we have pods, we have services, we have applications, how we talk to each other. So the basic difference of the Kubernetes, if you compare it with Docker Swarm and usual Docker network, is that in Kubernetes, you have one flat network internally, and every pod you have there is connected to this network and has its own IP address there. So you don't have this problem of port numbers overlapping between different applications and services, because every service, every pod has its own IP address assigned to it by the Kubernetes scheduler. And thus, you have a freedom as an application developer, as a creator of those pods and containers to use any kind of port you want. If it doesn't matter if one, the developer sitting next to you wants to use the port 80, he can, because you will use, obviously, you will use different IP addresses and everyone has the whole range of ports available. So there is external network which your nodes are connected to, and there is a flat internal network where pods live. And by default, these networks are not in any way not connected. I mean, no, this is not true exactly. So pods can access the internet usually. But from outside, if the question is how do you access the pods? Yeah, if there is just an internal network, there are some IP ranges, IP addresses, but no one knows how to reach those IP addresses from the outside. So before we get into that, we should think about services first. So how does load balancing works with this services mechanism? So in Kubernetes, every service has a virtual IP address assigned to it. So it is not a DNS entry, as it often happens. This is not a DNS because DNS is too slow in delivering the updates, basically. For Kubernetes, updating service endpoints and IP addresses happen very fast. And DNS is not reliable enough for this kind of microservices operations to deliver fast updates of IP addresses. That's why it was decided that services in Kubernetes are represented as a virtual IP addresses, and where the routing created on IP tables level for services to balance requests to the backend endpoints, which are pods of current service. So this, again, internally, every service has its own personal IP address from the IP range, and every pod can access a service by IP address or by name. But now we want to reach there from the outside, and there are different ways of doing that. Mainly, you need to route the traffic from outside through some node interface to internal network. So this is called, in the Kubernetes terms, exposing a service to outside, and you can expose the service as in different ways, but most basically, there's service can be exposed as node port. So what it means, you choose a certain port in a range, and then you assign this port to a service, and then every node in your cluster will have this port opened and redirected to this internal service inside Kubernetes. So you kind of don't have an IP address here, you have just a port. So every service represented as a port on the node, and you can access any node with this port to get to the same service. Obviously, accessing services via ports is not fun. You don't want to remember these ports by names. So Kubernetes has connectors to different cloud systems. For example, if you have Kubernetes platform deployed on AWS or on Google Cloud, then it can talk with Google API or AWS API. And once you create internally this service will be registered in AWS API. And the AWS will create a rule which will route this traffic to a certain port, again, on the cluster and route to this service. So you don't want to have your client services to discover your services by port, you will discover them by name, and Amazon will do, or Google, or your like certain bare metal hosted system, like console, can do that for you. But generally, the underlying concept is the same. So each node exposes a port. Port is mapped to a service. Now, there's more to it, but I want to go to I want to go to the more client-related stuff here. These were abstract concepts, but how do you work with them really in your like daily life? So Kubernetes has a kubectl command. This is a command line utility. It is very extremely verbose because it's kind of wrapper around the full REST API of a Kubernetes cluster. So every object is represented in this command line utility, and you can get objects, you can like list objects, describe them, update them, and so on. So this is a kind of a REST API handler. And while you can create all objects through command line by running some kubectl commands, you obviously don't want to do that all the time, manually typing all the options there. So all your object descriptions can be stored in YAML files, and these YAML files can be consumed by kubectl, or they can be consumed like on a, it's also possible to have a JSON format, but generally you have a repository with your YAML configurations, and then you just apply this, the whole folder of your YAML configurations to the cluster to do anything there. There is also a Kubernetes dashboard interface. This is a graphical web interface which provides you with overview of what you have, which nodes you have, which pods you have, how this is all going. But this web interface, again, it's a wrapper around the same REST API, but it has limited functionality. So kubectl should be your main option once you really work with it. And Kubernetes dashboard is an option for just having a generic overview. Now, this is two examples. How do you work with kubectl tool from command line? So for example, kubectl run command by default creates those deployment objects we talked about. So I set this replicas number to the number I want to have this starting number of my pods. I set the image because, like as I said, the default option is to have one container per pod, and this is what is handled here. If I set up this, specify this one image, I will have a pod created for it, and I have five instances of it created. And then I simply expose this deployment object to the outside world. Here I'm specifying the internal port on my application. My application is listened by some reason to port 5000. And I expose this to the outside world. I don't choose which node port I'm exposing this service on, because Kubernetes will take care of it. So I don't have a problem of overlapping ports again. So the idea is that you create your deployment objects, your services, your service accounts, and everything you need as a user of this cluster. You shouldn't be interrupted by another user who already have this port busy. That's why you don't choose here which node port you will use. Kubernetes will find it and will register the service to it. Then you will be able to discover this port, or your Amazon API or Google API will create this rule, so you will access service by name, and this port will be somewhere behind. You don't care which one exactly port it is. So every time there's a feature that you don't overlap with other people's work, so you have a full independent application. Fully independent applications don't clash in with each other, don't take in each other's ports and IP addresses. And one more thing is that this networking is not easy, and the networking you see from the outside is different from the networking setup you see from inside. And this is a very huge difference, yeah, because from outside you get this port mapping and a lot of translations in between. So sometimes you just want to know what's going on in the internal network and what's happening. Can pods talk to each other without going outside? And that's where debugging pod is helpful. You can create a simple pod just with one container, temporary. So it's not a part of a huge deployment object. It's not a part of a replica set. It's just one pod with one image, which is run temporarily. And as soon as you close the process, it gets killed and removed from a cluster. But this kind of debugging pod provides you the way to interactively get into the internal network. So you run it from your desktop, laptop, workstation. You get inside, you trigger this some debugging pod. In my example, it's a BusyBox, but BusyBox is actually a bad thing to use as a debugging pod because it has no nice tools to which you need to debug. So basically, you need to create a debugging image with like tools like TCP dump, nmap, curl, get, and so on. So you have your admin toolbox in this container image. When you run this container image, you get your interactive command line from inside this image, and then you all can work on internal network through this image and investigate what's going on there. Of course, there's much more to the topic, and there's like I covered only the most common deployment object because this is the first object you start working with. Then there's as well daemon sets, which allow you, for example, to deploy pods, at least one pod per node. So if you want a service which should be local to each node, you can set up a special scheduling algorithm, so the pods will be scheduled in such a way so every node in your cluster will have at least one instance of a pod of this type. You can have stateful sets, you can have more volumes, you can have jobs, you can have config maps and secrets, which means config maps is a, just things you can store in the internal Kubernetes cluster storage, and they can be added to your containers. So you can have some configuration options stored as a file, keep this file in the Kubernetes cluster itself, and let containers use this file on the fly. And you can update this file and containers will get it updated and so on. You can have the same but for secrets with additional safety measures. You can have service accounts, which are like, again, your pod can use certain authentication methods which are stored on the Kubernetes level and so on. So Kubernetes adds more and more abstract objects to help you with solving those typical tasks so you don't do this stuff on your own. But yeah, we can start with basics and dig from there. So basically, this was my all content. If you have any questions, you can ask now. Anything interesting? Yeah?
What do you think about running databases?
Okay. Yeah, the question was what I'm thinking about running databases in Kubernetes. So I don't think about it. The main reason, obviously databases are a completely different use case from a common stateless microservices. And if you really need to run them in Kubernetes, you maybe should try, but I think this is way out of the scope of what Kubernetes provides currently. So for me, the Kubernetes, as you probably saw from the talk, how I frame it, Kubernetes is a platform for deployment pipeline, where your deployment pipeline comes to. And it's very useful when you have those hundreds of applications, development teams working on them independently, and everyone can manage their stuff and you can test it properly and so on. So this is a very nice platform to solve all your integration deployment tasks. But it doesn't add anything in case of a database management from my point of view, at least now. So no, I'm not thinking about it. Anything else? Yeah.
What do you think about
one moment
Kubernetes for a different application area?
What do you think about using Kubernetes for a different application area, a classical one, like having classical containers, LXC containers or similar, and Ansible or Puppet inside a stateful approach, not a stateless as yours with Docker? Mm-hmm. And in order to marry these both worlds.
Okay, take it back. To be honest, like there are a lot of stuff happening in Kubernetes world, so we cannot even imagine where we'll end up in 2 years. There might be very many different applications of the Kubernetes approach, but. From my side, as a continuous integration engineer, not the low-level maybe sysadmin, I see a lot of benefit of using Kubernetes kind of API with different backends. So extending, having this Kubernetes concept of replica sets, deployment objects, service accounts, management tools, but replacing the backend to different kind of implementation, be it Docker, be it VMs, be it process on a host, why not? Yeah, so this is also could be nice and interesting because like we're really eager for that way of managing our deployments and way of giving developers a way to manage these deployments. But we are flexible in terms of how exactly this is implemented on a base level. Yeah.
Any thoughts on this?
From my side, no. So, okay. Yep. I'll repeat.
There was one part in that question. Maybe if you use the microphone.
Yeah, yeah. We'll just.
I thought I was loud enough.
But it's for recording as well.
There was one part in that question. Can you handle stateful images?
Yes, Kubernetes has this concept of stateful sets, which is the way of handling stateful images. But it's from what I remember, it's in the early stage of development. I mean, it appeared in 1.6 release or something like this year. So I don't know the current like production readiness for this kind of setup, and I've never heard about this kind of production readiness, but maybe it's just me. So I'm not exactly the expert in this particular topic, because for the purpose of our setup, we have very nice microservices-friendly internal project, which is like really truly stateless and can connect to the database, which is remote and live separately. So I haven't dig into this topic. I heard that there's stateful sets, but I never use them. Yep. Give it there.
Do you have experience with the amount of needed Kubernetes cluster in a company? So we currently have a setup on AWS where we create for each project one Kubernetes cluster for test environment and staging and one for production. So we have, for example, then 20 to 30 Kubernetes cluster. Other way of thinking is maybe to create just one or two really big Kubernetes cluster with a really huge amount of nodes. So,
from my point of view, I think that splitting up these workloads to different clusters is a better way to go. I mean, even for kind of just development for different teams, I would have different clusters for them to play with. Because they will have a flexibility and they don't break each other's stuff this way. So I believe in many clusters, Because I believe that this YAML approach to Kubernetes cluster configuration is very helpful in this way. So you can migrate your configurations from one cluster to another easily. So unless you really need the interaction between these projects, why do you put them in one place? So once you have this infrastructure as a code approach, you just create your clusters as you need them and use them. That's what I think about it. So let me clarify maybe, because from the questions I heard. So currently we are working on our like new greenfield projects. We are digging in, so we are not maybe that experienced as you, for example. So this is our how we look into it and how we plan to do this. Maybe like in 1 year you will ask me and I'll say, no, it's completely different and this is a different way. But for now, yeah, this is the way I would go.
What's the overhead of deploying a Kubernetes cluster? How much resources does it need to just do nothing and sit there?
This is a good question, which I cannot answer you right now. This is something we need to investigate more on our setup. So, like, just to to have a understanding. No, I don't have numbers with me right now. So
it's also a question to the auditorium.
Yeah, yeah.
The reason why I was asking my first question.
Because we have experience that always creating a new cluster for some environment just eats up a lot of resources.
Expensive.
Yeah, of course it will be more expensive. The thing is, like, what's more expensive? The cluster resources or the resources of the developers who will work on this setup? And this is always the trade-off. Yeah, you can go very effective hardware-wise, but then your developers will struggle, and then like your effectiveness doesn't bring you that much.
So what we have, what our experience is, what you need. So when we have a setup in AWS, for example, and you need a high available setup, so you have these master nodes which are used to control the Kubernetes cluster, and then you want to spread the nodes over the AZs, over the availability zones. So you have then on our setup three master nodes for each cluster, and then the worker nodes, and even the worker nodes are splitted over the availability zones. So we have always a setup with three master nodes and three worker nodes. That's our minimal setup. And what you can, where you can work with, especially when you have such a cloud setup, is how you size the nodes. So for example, when you have just a development cluster, you can take smaller EC2 instances than, for example, for production. And then, of course, you can scale up and down. But especially for this high availability setup, you need minimum spread at the nodes over the availability zones.
Yep.
My question is also about the scalability, because I had some experiences with Kubernetes. And for my setup, I also used three nodes, but I have had a problem. So I don't like the scalability of Kubernetes, because as soon as one node of this three breaks down, the containers are not scheduled about across the different servers which are still running. So as soon as run etcd instance break down for my whole cluster, or the at least the services from the one, were down, and they were not scheduled back to the other nodes.
That's not true. I mean, that if this happens in your setup, this obviously is a bug, because this is the idea of Kubernetes cluster. If your one node goes down, you have your rescheduling of the pods to the other available nodes. So probably, like,
yes, as soon as I had four, it was of course scaled down to three. But as soon as it was going under three, it didn't scale. So I had to at least three running nodes to have the high availability.
That's an interesting topic to discuss. Like, are you sure it's not, it wasn't because you just resources were not available on those remaining nodes and your ports
as,
were...
As soon as one etcd instance break down from SWE.
Okay, then whereas like etcd services can be also clusterized in different ways, so it might depend on your setup, on you might dig into it, because like obviously it's not designed to work this way, and obviously the idea is that once you have this high available cluster, you can take out the etcd node. And I had the deployment of Kubernetes done by KubeSpray, which was Cargo project recently, but now it's KubeSpray. And I tested this killing of one of the master nodes, and it was recovering, and it worked for me. So we can think about how it was, yeah.
And another question was, how can I set up a Kubernetes on my local laptop? So as I'm working as a developer on the run, how can I set up an environment here and can test deployment and things
that's,
like that?
That's an awesome question, because I almost forgot to tell you about it. One thing Docker added to, I think, the development environment generally is that now people start to care about the onboarding of new people rather than just inventing, developing the technology itself. So Kubernetes project learned its lesson from Docker and created a lot of documentation, a lot of tooling around to help people to get on board, because like it appears that it's very important. So now there's this Minikube tool. You can download it from Git, from GitHub, and this is the Minikube. Looks like, okay, I need to have some link, but so there is this Minikube tool which you can download. This Minikube tool allows you to set up your own developer sandbox with Kubernetes. So it's a very easy setup of like what it does under the hood. It goes to Google, fetches the VM image, downloads it to your local instance, set up your run this virtual image, and this virtual image internally contains the Kubernetes cluster. This is a one-node cluster, so it's not a development production-ready Kubernetes setup, but it's a full cluster with services which you can use as a developer to test stuff, to run these replica sets, to run pods, and to deal to play with the Kubernetes cluster. So I have it running, and I think this is even works sometimes. And you can see that it's this Minikube utility automatically configures your authentication locally, so that your kubectl tool starts to work with this Minikube cluster. So it, you can see that I can access this cluster with kubectl utility. I can also try to look into dashboard of this particular Minikube instance. So you can see that I have only one node. This is a VM which Minikube downloaded. I have some deployment objects. Actually, this is a one deployment object running here, and with five instances. And yeah, I probably can see the pods here, the five pods running on this Kubernetes cluster. And so this Minikube is like full Kubernetes here on your laptop. You work with the API, and the things you do with this API, you store them in YAML files, you go to your production cluster, upload the same YAML files, and get the same result. Obviously, not on the multi-node level, because this is only one node we have, but you can test the deployment strategies, you can see how updates is rolled out one by one, and so on. So look, as a playground for developers, this is an awesome tool. Anything else?
What are ingresses?
What are ingresses?
So Ingress is a way to route the traffic not by port alone, but by rules. So you can assign a set of rules and say if some, basically HTTP rules, you can create this proxy on a level of like virtual host level. If you specify different virtual hosts, if you specify different different paths, they will be routed to different services. So it's a, ingress is the next level of a node port. When you wrap around the node port and you do the routing on a more rich with richer rules now, nowadays. It's not a replacement for DNS. It's basically a proxy of a seventh level proxy. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. So I hope you got interested and will try this Minikube stuff at home and enjoy how easy it is to live with it, because yeah, it's really like. Very nice tool to work with. Of course, this is not the problemless tool. There are complications, and this is just the tip of an iceberg. And as I said, this the content of a talk just helps to get you on board. Then, like, there is a lot to learn, and for me as well, it's just we have just started with this journey. And yeah, as I said, there are questions, discussions, and we're obviously hiring. So if you're interested, come talk to me. Thanks.